going to find out today why a leading Israeli thinker says that Donald Trump is the first Zionist president.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to today's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. This is Michael Brown. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call if you have a Jewish-related question. It's got to be Jewish-related. Hebrew-related, could be related to Messianic prophecy, Israel today, Judaism, various things like that. As long as it's Jewish-related, glad to take your calls. 866-348-7884. A lot of ground to cover, a very, very big week in the Jewish world, a historic week. In terms of the president's peace plan, we commented on it immediately. As soon as it was announced, got as much information as I could, made some preliminary comments, put out a video commentary, put out an article. And the more things sit, the more we look at them, the more I feel that the initial comments, initial understanding, all this was correct. But I want to dig in deeper today. I want to give you more insight and then talk to you about an editorial by Carolyn Glick, a leading American-Israeli thinker, in terms of why this is so historic and why she says that Donald Trump is the first Zionist president. First, there's an article on the JTA, Jewish Telegraph Association, that says Trump's Israeli peace plan runs 181 pages. These two maps tell you what you need to know. And there are two maps that are very detailed. So this is what the president and his team put out, detailed maps. And something that strikes me is very interesting. You have Israel proper, all right? And for those watching, I'm going to leave these maps up for a little while. We have Israel proper, and then you have what would be a Palestinian state. So Israel proper is in kind of a beige color, and then a light blue, that would be the Palestinian state. So it's largely within Israel's borders, but the majority of it is on the West Bank of the Jordan. This is historic Judea, Samaria, biblically, but known as the West Bank today in terms of when people just in the world generally speaking about it. And then on the southwest side of Israel, you have the Gaza Strip. And these are separated. And because of Hamas ruling over Gaza, being the elected governmental entity over Gaza, Gaza has basically been cut off by Israel in many ways because of being run by a terrorist organization that wants to destroy the nation of Israel and the Jewish people living in the land of Israel. So what about families that are separated? What do they do? Well, there's going to be a tunnel. And that's what's so fascinating, that there would be a 30-mile tunnel that would connect the West Bank to the Gaza Strip. So that would be a first. And then those from the Gaza Strip that want to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and have access to that part of Jerusalem that come in peace would be able to do so under the plan. But overwhelmingly, you could say that this favors Israel territorially. But the whole thing is to say, let's make a way for the Palestinian people to live with freedom and to live with prosperity and to live with the ability to make choices. How do the Palestinians react? Well, we'll look at that in a moment. But a few headlines of interest here. All right. Jerusalem Post reports this, that Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates welcome the Trump peace plan. So here's Saudi Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The kingdom reiterates its support for all efforts aimed at reaching a just and comprehensive resolution to the Palestinian cause. You say, does that represent a change? Because up until now, there has been overwhelming solidarity of these surrounding nations with the Palestinians as long as they're in their land. There has not been solidarity in saying, hey, just come live with us, be incorporated into our land. See, when roughly 800,000 Jews had to flee the Muslim Arab lands in which they lived with the establishment of the State of Israel in 1947-48, they became refugees. what did they do? The great majority were absorbed within Israel proper. The rest went to other parts of the world, Canada, America, South America, wherever else they were able to go and take refuge, Europe, etc. But the great bulk were absorbed in the new nation of Israel. What happened to the roughly 600,000 Arabs that were living there? They weren't known as the Palestinians at that time, that were living there, that because of the aggressive stance of the surrounding nations and the refusal of the partition plan of the United Nations, what happened to those refugees? They remain as refugees to this day. It's the only case like this that we've had where you still have the UN recognizing them as refugees. You can even go into towns and cities in the West Bank, and they still have refugee camps of Palestinians living within Palestinian territory. You go to Syria and Lebanon, they still have refugee camps. Why didn't all the surrounding Muslim and Arab nations just embrace them and say, well, you come live with us. We speak the same language. We worship the same God. We're Muslims. Just come live with us. Why didn't they do that? Yeah, a small minority Christian, but why didn't they just, well, because then you don't have this bargaining chip against Israel, and you can't make Israel look bad. This is a strategy from the 50s of the Arab League to say, no, we will not resettle the refugees in our lands. That's why they remain as refugees generations later. Mm-hmm. Who suffers? They do. They do. So up until now, the Palestinian cause has been used as a pawn against Israel, as a tool, as a wedge issue against Israel. But now these surrounding nations, with whom America's had increasingly good relationships over the years, now these surrounding nations say, hey, we have a path to prosperity working with Israel. So Palestinians, come on, get on board. And if not, we're going to work with Israel because we have a path to regional peace and prosperity. And then Iran is looked at as an arch enemy by so many of them as well. It's like, well, let's stand together and work together if we can. So Palestinians, get on board. So another headline, this is a Wall Street Journal, same thing. Arab leaders' support for Mideast peace plan marks a regional shift. Tentative backing of U.S. proposal reflects changing priorities, frustration with the Palestinians, and more willingness to work with Israel. So this is major. You say, well, how do the Palestinians respond? What's their reaction? How do they feel about this? Well, what did Ilhan Omar have to say? She said that the deal of the century is theft and erasure. Theft and erasure. You're going to be stealing Palestinian land. Actually, it's historic Israel land, Jewish land. But you're going to be stealing Israel's land. That's what it comes down to, or Palestinian land. It is erasing them as a people. Theft and erasure. That was her response. Let's look at some more Palestinian responses. On commondreams.org. This is the Palestinian response. This is not a peace plan. It is a war plan. Trump Netanyahu deal decried a shameful attack on Palestinian rights. And tell you what, let's read a few quotes from this article. Again, Ilhan Omar, this is not a peace plan. It is theft. It is erasure. She says they could have guaranteed justice and brought everyone into this peace deal. Instead, these two embattled heads of state, impeached and indicted, so attacking Trump and Netanyahu, have a just us peace deal. It's shameful and disingenuous. And feminist activists, Muslim activists, anti-Israel activist Linda Sarsour tweeted, a peaceful plan without Palestinians is not a peace plan. It's a re-election campaign strategy for Donald Trump. And Palestinian Authority Chairman Mahmoud Abbas said this should be thrown into the dustbin of history. Trash it. In point of fact, while the overall agreement is very positive in terms of Israel, is pro-Israel in many ways, it's also pro-Palestinian. The fact of the matter is the United Nations is still saying 1967 borders. I mean, this was a shocker to read. Times of Israel. United Nations says committed to pre-1967 borders, stresses that the settlements are illegal. So United Nations is still wanting to go back in time. Pre-1967 indefensible borders. It would make the narrowest part of Israel about 9 miles wide, surrounded by hostile entities on either side. Think of that. indefensible borders, borders that were expanded through war against attack to wipe them out, all right? So justly and rightly exploited borders. And then to not recognize the settlements on top of this is to say the only way there can be a Palestinian state is with no Jews living in it. And that's the bottom line. So how many Arabs that would also be called Palestinians today live in what everyone recognizes right now as Israel? When we refer to Israel, that's what we're talking about. So not the West Bank, not Gaza Strip, but what others would refer to as Israel. How many Palestinian Arabs live there now? It's about 2 million. Is it that high now? But around 2 million. Mm-hmm. So if the population of the Jewish people there is about 6 million, Palestinians there, it's about 2 million or close to that. All right. Well, why can you have an Israeli state with Palestinian Arabs living in its midst, but a Palestinian state can't have any Jews living in its midst? I mean, doesn't that sound like the old days of bigotry and hatred and anti-Semitism? No Jews in our midst? You say, well, that's the whole thing, though. The settlements get better treatment. The settlements get better water. The settlements get better land. The settlements get protection. And some of the settlers are bad people. Yes, some of the settlers are bad people. Some of the settlers are Arab haters. That's true. Some of them are hostile and negative. And yeah, that's true. And they need to be called to account by the Israeli government, by the Israeli people. But the fact of the matter is, the peace plan is saying, we want to pour into the region. And we want to pour into your economic system, which will then affect your educational system. And we want to give you more connection to other families in the region. And we want to give you more access to the holy places in Jerusalem for you. And we want you to do well, but you're going to have to give up some of your dream. And that means recognize this is Israel. That's the reality. This is Israel, but you can have your own governed place in the midst of it. And even a capital in East Jerusalem. And it's interesting, as we're going to look in a moment at what Caroline Glick had to say, what's interesting is that she has been a strong proponent of the one-state solution, and yet she recognizes that this is the best offer Israel's ever gotten. I think later today, if I have time, I'm going to write an article asking the question, do you still think Donald Trump is an anti-Semite? Really? You still think so? We're not talking about racist or misogynist or xenophobic or any of the other accusations. But you still think, even after this peace plan, that Donald Trump is an anti-Semite? All right, we'll be right back. 866-34-TRUTH with your Jewish-related questions.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on the Line of Fire. Just a reminder, if you live anywhere near St. Louis, I'll be ministering at Grace Church right outside of St. Louis this entire weekend. Friday night, I believe, is young adults. Saturday morning, men's meeting. And then three weekend services for everyone, Saturday night and two Sunday morning services each with a different topic. So join me as many of those fit. Obviously, if you're a lady, you can't come to the women's meeting. And if you're like 90, it's probably not best to come to the young adults meeting, although no one would exclude you. But welcome, everyone. Look forward to seeing you. Details are on my itinerary at askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Look for itinerary. All right, before I go back to discussion about the Middle East peace plan, I want to take some phone calls, 866-34-TRUTH. We'll start in Brooklyn. Chris, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, God bless you, Dr. Brown.
God bless you.
Caller, long-time listener.
Well, thank you, sir.
You're welcome. I have a question on some Jewish customs here in that I found in the Word.
Mm-hmm.
Second Chronicles 35 and 25 speaks about singing men and singing women, making it a custom in Israel. And Matthew 9:23 speaks about when Jesus came into the house of Jairus, and then he saw flute players and a crowd. So my question is, do these customs connect? Do the customs connect in the verses? What are the customs when somebody is dying? Or what was the custom in that time?
Right.
Does this still happen in the Jewish culture?
Yeah, what you're looking at was not something that was so much a Jewish custom. So this is mourning and lament. Josiah dies in 2 Chronicles 35, and there's mourning and lament, or Jairus' daughter dies, obviously, before they know Jesus is going to raise her from the dead. So there's mourning and lamenting. What you basically had in the ancient Middle East, and you still have this today in certain parts of the world, is kind of mourning rites, that when there's an announcement, there's weeping, announcement of death, there's weeping and wailing, and you even have some people who are professional mourners, and they join in with wailing and lamenting, and it's just part of the culture. Judaism developed instead certain prayers that are prayed, words that are said, customs that are followed. For example, the ripping of the clothes would be an immediate sign of mourning. And then in different Jewish traditions, instead of ripping your clothes, you put on like a black strip of fabric. You pin it to your garment to signify mourning. When you hear, when someone tells you so-and-so just died, then you immediately respond with blessed be the righteous judge, and may the Lord comfort you. And so there's certain things you do. And then the custom of what's called sitting Shiva, which is much later. I don't know exactly when that came in, but Shiva 7, that for 7 days after the burial, you sit and comfort the mourner. So within Jewish practice, you bury the person within 24 hours, unless it's Sabbath. So everything happens with tremendous suddenness. If it's a sudden, unexpected death, then everything has to be done quickly. People travel in as quickly as possible. You have the funeral service, and then 7 days after that, people come to your home and mourn with you and console you and encourage you and cook and bring things for you. So those are some of the customs. And then there are, again, various prayers that are prayed and laws that are followed in terms of cleanness and uncleanness and touching a corpse and all of that. But that type of mourning reflects more Middle Eastern custom than specific Jewish custom.
Okay, great. Sounds good.
Yep.
So just one more quick question. The professional mourners?
Yeah.
Those were their jobs, or like, is that somebody that we can compare to nowadays as like funeral directors and the such?
Yeah, you could compare it. In other words, the jobs are totally different, but just like there is an industry of sorts that revolves around death and burial and those things involving it, that you had some of that. So it's vastly different culturally. But yeah, there were people, that's what they did. How often they did it, what they were paid, or how they're, that is another subject. But that they existed, we certainly know. And in fact, you know, a passage that would point to this is in Jeremiah, the 9th chapter. Jeremiah chapter 9, and it's again pointing to this not just being a spontaneous, someone just mourning because somebody died. God's saying that judgment is coming. And Jeremiah 9, starting in verse 20, "Now hear the word of the Lord, you women. Pay attention to the word of his mouth. Teach your daughters a lament and one another a dirge. For death has climbed through our windows. It has entered our fortresses, cutting off children from the streets, young men from the squares. Speak as follows. This is what the Lord says. Human corpses will fall like manure on the surface of the field, like newly cut grain after the reaper." And it goes on with that. So it's, you know, gather the mourning women, teach them a lament. That in verse 17, this is what the Lord of hosts says. "Consider and summon the women who mourn. Send for the skillful women. Let them come quickly to raise a lament over us, that our eyes may overflow with tears, our eyelids soaked with weeping." So it would be the mourning, the wailing, but also the composing of laments. You know, that would be kind of similar to eulogies today. So again, parallels are not exact, but that gives you a bit more of the feeling of the culture. Hey, Chris, thank you for listening, and thank you for calling in. 866 1-800-634-TRUTH. Let's go to George in Orlando, Florida. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. McBrock. How are you?
Hey. Good.
So I have a question about the Middle East conflict.
Yep.
In regards to, like, the Jewish people with the Palestinians, or even with the Jewish people and the broader Arab world, is there a connection that we Christians are supposed to make between that and what's written in Genesis about Jacob and Esau? Or I remember about it will be at enmity towards the other. Is there something there or no?
Yeah, so George, you cut out at one point, but I believe I heard your question. Jacob and Esau is more specific, okay? So Jacob representing Israel, Esau specifically comes to represent Edom, the nation of Edom, and then broader connotations from there. But the conflict, if you wanted to look at the larger Jewish-Arab conflict in a broader way, then you would say that's Isaac and Ishmael, okay? Isaac and Ishmael. So it's a conflict between brothers, both sons of Abraham, both in the Arab world becoming primarily Muslim, both looking to Abraham as spiritual father, okay? So that going on as well. But the question is, how do we translate in Genesis chapter 16? Genesis 16, when there is a word spoken over Ishmael, okay? And it says, verse 12, I'm going to read it in a few different translations. Genesis 16, 12, King James, and he'll be a wild man. His hand will be against every man and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. New King James, the same. CSB, he will live at odds with all his brothers. ESV, he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. NIV, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers. NET, he will live away from his brothers. CJB, living his life at odds with all his kinsmen. New Jewish Publication Society, he shall dwell alongside all of his kinsmen. So the question, George, is there a prophecy there that there will always be enmity between Ishmael and Isaac, or between the sons of Israel and ultimately the larger Arab world? That verse does not necessarily say it. You could just as well read that in terms of a geographical statement as opposed to a statement of hostility. We look forward to the day, though, of Isaiah the 19th chapter, when Egypt and Assyria, today would be Egypt and Iraq in terms of where those nations are, but Egypt and Assyria will worship Yahweh, the God of Israel, together with Israel, that they will all as one worship the one true God. That's what we look forward to. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Preston in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question about Romans 11, 25 and 26, where Paul writes that all Israel will be saved. And I was just wondering, how would that work? And if there was going to be some national revelation of Jesus to the Jewish people?
Yeah, very important verses. And of course, I've commented on them many a time. In short, there will be a national turning. How it will happen, I believe there'll be many factors. One is the prayers of the church and the witness of the church. Another will be tremendous calamity and pressure and challenge. Another will be the power of the Holy Spirit working through Jewish believers in the land. And remember, you've got centuries of prayer and intercession, and somehow all these things coming together will come to that point where you get to in Zechariah 12, 10, Vihibitu Eli Tashir Dakaro Vasaf Dualav, they'll look to the one they've pierced, or they'll look to me if they've pierced, and they'll mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, that somehow the veil will be lifted. The hardness that exists in part now will be removed. What the numbers of the nation will be at the end of the age, God knows, as it's a time of shaking for the whole world. But yes, somehow there'll be national revelation, somehow national opening of hearts, minds, eyes, with true repentance to turn to Jesus, the Messiah. All right, we'll come back with some more of your calls. We'll talk about Donald Trump, the first Zionist president.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome, friends, to the Line of Fire. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. I want to go through a very important article written by Carolyn Glick. And it is posted on Israel Hayom, so it's Israel Today, and it's called Trump's Heroic Truth and Israel's Historic Opportunity. If you have a Jewish-related question, 866-348-7884, or something that relates to this peace plan, by all means, give us a call. But I want to go through this article. It's filled with insight, and Carolyn Glick is a respected Israeli thinker, worked closely with different governments in Israel, has been a strong opponent of the two-state solution, and has written a book about a one-state solution. So her response to the president's peace plan is very interesting. So I want you to hear this. I want to go through it with you. All right. So she says this: in Israel's early years, every time the U.S. ambassador traveled to Jerusalem to meet with government leaders, he would have a chauffeur stop his car at the entrance to the city and replace its diplomatic license plates with regular civilian plates. The State Department refused to recognize that Jerusalem was part of Israel. The license plates were for Israel, and so in a show of contempt and rejection of Israel's right to its capital city, he removed his diplomatic plates before entering Jerusalem and put them back on when he left. President Harry Truman was the first world leader to recognize the State of Israel just moments after David Ben-Gurion declared its independence on May 14, 1948, but his recognition was skin deep. Truman, like all of his successors until Donald Trump, recognized Israel's existence but didn't recognize the Jewishness of Israel. Now, there's a point she's making here. Let's make sure we get it. He saw Israel as a refuge for Holocaust survivors and other Jews fleeing persecution, but he didn't accept that the nation of Israel in 1948 was the nation of Israel from the Bible. He didn't accept that the Jewish refugees in European DP camps were the descendants of the prophets, or that the forefathers of the kibbutzniks in the Jezreel Valley were the priests at the temple in Jerusalem. In other words, what she's saying is that they saw that the Jewish people needed a homeland. They saw that this was the logical place for a homeland. They recognized there was a certain connection to the land, but basically you've got the Jews, you've got the Arabs, you've got these different players here. They all have a claim to the land, but look, it's post-Holocaust and it's a terrible time, so let's have a homeland for the Jewish people without recognizing this has always been the homeland. Now, there may have been words to that effect, but there's a recognition of it that was lacking, as she will explain. She says Israel, as far as Truman was concerned, was a new state, a poor state of Jewish refugees, and he treated it accordingly. Remember, Israel then is not like Israel today. Truman's anti-historical view of the Jewish state produced a two-faced American policy towards Israel. On the one hand, the American officials spoke warmly of the Jewish homeland. On the other hand, they treated Israel like a beggar that should be thankful for scraps and loose change. This patronizing American approach changed after the 1967 Six-Day War. President Lyndon Johnson realized that a nation capable of triumphing over four enemy armies in 6 days and tripling its size as a nation worthy of respect and better treatment. Johnson upgraded Israel militarily and supported it diplomatically in the aftermath of the war. But America's ambivalence towards Zionism, the liberation movement of the ancient Jewish people, persevered. The United States' adamant refusal to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and Washington's opposition to all Jewish settlements in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza attest it to this fact. In other words, it's really not your land. You have a state here, but it's limited. It's not really your land. For America, she writes, to recognize the legitimacy of Israel's control and Israel's sovereign rights to these areas, America's leaders would need to recognize the simple fact that Israel is not a refuge for a persecuted, pitiable people, but the homeland of the eternal nation of Israel. Two different ways of looking at it, right? She says, and all U.S. presidents until Trump preferred to deny this truth. As a matter of U.S. policy, they transferred the Jewish nation's historical rights to the Palestinians, who have no national history. Despite what you hear, friends, the Palestinians do not connect back to the land of Israel over a period of 3,000-plus years. The vast majority of the Arabs living in the land of Israel have only lived there within the last century-plus, and many with only the last few generations or before the founding of the state of Israel, those immediate generations. The population as a whole was very, very small, and it was considered part of greater Syria or just larger Ottoman Empire, whatever, but there was not a Palestinian people, Palestinian identity. That's recognized. It's been repeated over and over. So people living there, yeah, that may have been their ancestral home for generations, and there may have been a very small amount that go back to actually Jewish roots that converted to Islam. So they remained in the land after the destruction of the temple and so on, and they remained in the land and then centuries later converted to Islam or were forcibly converted to Islam, and they have a more ancient pedigree. But the vast majority, the growth in numbers in that part of the world in terms of the Arab Muslim population is only towards the late 1800s, and that really begins to grow as more and more Jews begin to come back to the land and develop the land. Now there's more work for the Arab farmers and others and their colleagues, so the populations grow accordingly. But the only ones that have the ancient historic claim through the millennia, that's the Jewish people. So she then says this. Then, 3 years ago, Trump entered the White House. Tuesday, Trump said that Israel is a light to the nations, that the land of Israel is the promised land and the historic homeland of the Jewish people. He said that Jerusalem cannot be liberated because it's already been liberated. He said that no one will be removed from their home for peace. Among other things, he conditioned Palestinian statehood on full Palestinian recognition of the Jewish people's rights to their historic homeland in the land of Israel. Ahead of Trump's announcement, now check this out, Barack Obama's ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, delivered a not particularly veiled threat to Israelis who might be tempted to accept Trump's framework for peace. Shapiro stunned the diplomatic world when he refused to leave Israel at the end of his term and instead took a position at a left-leaning Israeli think tank. He has used his position to criticize President Trump's Middle East policies. In an interview with Army Radio Sunday, Shapiro said, "I think Israeli citizens should take into account that in less than a year, there could be a new Democratic administration. If not in a year, then in 5 years. Trump won't be president forever. It's important to know that any Democratic candidate will oppose this plan and that no Democratic president will be bound by it." Wow. So he's saying, don't you dare get at home with these settlements or think that they're going to be recognized by America long term, because when a Democrat comes in, he's going to undo that. Wow. Yeah, he's Jewish. He's living in Israel, but he is left-leaning and was part of the Obama administration, which was not a good friend of Israel. Shapiro continued, "If Trump is encouraging Israel to take unilateral steps, such as annexing the Jordan Valley and the settlement blocks, that guarantees there will be a clash with a Democratic administration in less than a year." So he's really planning on that, Trumpian out. "I don't think this is a positive thing for the relations between the countries, and I advise against immediate actions that future administrations will oppose." Now, before I get back to her article, let me throw this out. Even if there are a lot of things about President Trump that you may not like, if you believe that Israel's right to its historic land is God-given and Israel's security is important in God's sight, and that can exist with well-being for the Palestinians, I'm convinced of it. I'm very much convinced of that. But if you believe that's important, that would be another reason for him to be reelected. Even if there are things you don't like and things about him that you feel are negative or destructive, this would be another major thing. You say, well, this could be a reason that he would be reelected or that you would vote for him. All right. Carolyn Glick says, Shapiro continued. So this is former Israeli ambassador under Barack Obama, Shapiro. He continued, "If Trump is encouraging Israel..." Oh, okay. Sorry. Read that. In other words, Shapiro said, "If Israel supports Trump's plan, which supports Israel in ways that no previous president ever did, least of all Shapiro's boss, Obama, the Democrats will punish Israel for doing so." This is what Shapiro's saying. not Ben Shapiro, Dan Shapiro. If Israel wants good relations with a democratic administration in the future, it will need to agree to not secure its interests, not now and not ever. That's what Carolyn Glick is saying. He is saying, Shapiro is saying on behalf of the Democrats. It is not at all clear that blue and white leader, so blue and white, the opposition party to Likud, the party with the most votes now along with Likud, that blue and white leader Benny Gantz understands the gravity of the moment. Shapiro essentially reinforced the point that Trump is providing Israel with a chance to secure its interests that isn't likely to receive again. The fact that Gantz thought it was appropriate to attack Netanyahu from Washington on Monday indicates that he places his personal ambitions above the good of the country. So, too, it is far from clear that the leaders of the Israeli communities in Judea and Samaria understand the significance of Trump's actions. On Tuesday, Trump recognized the truth as the foundation of Zionism and made that truth the foundation of America's policy regarding the Palestinian conflict with Israel, that this is Israel's land, fundamental. Trump, she writes, is a true friend of the Jewish people. He didn't offer us a perfect plan, but he offered us a plan we can live with. That alone sets it apart from all the American plans that preceded it. It would be a sin for us not to support it. Netanyahu pledged to apply Israeli law to the Jordan Valley and the Israeli communities in Judea Samaria on Sunday. Every Jew in Israel and worldwide should expect that he and his ministers fulfill this pledge. And every Jew in Israel and worldwide should feel thankful to Trump for his friendship and for his courage to embrace the truth. Wow. Those are strong words from Carolyn Glick. And you just have to realize that this is a major shift. I don't know if you'll remember this. I doubt that most of you would. But in my days of greatest hostility to candidate Donald Trump during the primaries, in my days of raising the most cautions and concerns about him, in my days of viewing him in the most negative possible ways, I did not believe he was an anti-Semite. And my friend Rabbi Shmuley wrote an article saying that he wasn't an anti-Semite. And yet he gets, to this day, he gets blasted as an anti-Semite. So even then, in my most hostile anti-Trump days, when I saw his flaws and his shortcomings and his failings and his sins much more clearly than I saw any good that he could do or trusted him that he would keep his word, even then, I didn't think he was an anti-Semite. How much more now do I not think that he is an anti-Semite? How much more now are my views confirmed? And the views of others confirm that he really does have a heart for Israel, and he really does see the Jewish perspective. But as he said, we've got to be fair to the Palestinians. Now, Palestinians say it's not fair at all. Some of the surrounding Arab nations, they're saying, good deal, get on with it. Let's use this as a framework to move forward. And they see this is a way to economic prosperity and peace in the region. All right, right back with your Jewish-related calls, 866 Before truth.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Shout, shouts of joy, and victory resound in the tents of the righteous.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Is this a true two-state solution that the president proposed that can be debated? Is it basically saying Palestinian recognition and sovereignty within a larger Jewish state? You could argue for that. The question is, unless you're going to drive everyone out of the land that's not Jewish, then you're going to have other people living there, right? You're going to have others living there, Christian, Muslim, Arab, you know, ethnic, religious groups. You're going to have them living there. In what setting? How is it going to work out? 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Robert in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. God bless you.
God bless you.
Thank you, sir. I had a question about the stark contrast in what you know, I would, maybe not doctrine, but ideas or instruction, because the Torah means instruction, between the Gentile Christians and the Hebrew people that have received Yeshua, Jesus the Christ, as the Messiah, Son of God. You know, the there's a lot of discord, or, you know, there's not much agreement on what the Word of God says regarding, you know, things, mainly the Ten Commandments. We could start with that, really. That is there, should Christians and Jewish people that receive Yeshua do as the Torah says, that be under one instruction? You know, it says that there should be one instruction for the house of Israel and the stranger within the gates, which basically would mean, you know, convert.
Yeah, Sir Robert, yeah, that was under the Sinai Covenant. We're not under the Sinai Covenant. And that was only
for
Gentiles living within the community of Israel. So the New Testament is very, very plain on that. No, the Torah law does not apply to Gentile believers. There are certain fundamental moral commandments that are universal for all people, and the greater commandments of the New Covenant to love one another as Yeshua loved us. But no, the rest of the commandments, the dietary laws, for example, the purity laws and other aspects of the Sinai Covenant, no, those were never considered binding for Gentile Christians. Acts 15 is as explicit could be. Paul in his letters reiterates that. But not only so, in Jesus, none of us are under the Sinai Covenant. We're all under a new and better covenant. And just as Paul gives instructions to men and to women and to masters and to slaves and to parents and to children, there are things for Jews and there are things for Gentiles. So we don't all have to do everything the same way to be part of the same larger family. And there
Are the Ten Commandments eternal to you, or have they been like removed? I mean, this is a legitimate question. The Ten Commandments. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with Sunday worship. I'm not one of those guys. I even go to churches and visit churches sometimes on Sundays. It's a wonderful thing. I enjoy it. And it is part of our early tradition as part of the true church. But the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandments actually can be called the will of God, the testimony.
Well, just explain, are the Ten Commandments part of the Sinai Covenant?
No, they're not. They're part of reality of the Lord's will.
Tell you what, here's the problem once again. I hate when this happens because I want to help people, but if you ask me a question and talk, I can't answer you. So, Robert, please listen carefully. And I remember after a debate with Rabbi Shmuley in New York City, a Jewish woman came up to me and asked me a question, and the moment I began to answer, she began to shake her head back and forth, no, with each question. And I said, you're not even listening to me. She said, I'm listening. I said, you're not listening, because the moment I opened my mouth, I could just say, la, 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 la. Or I could say, the sky is blue. Her head was shaking, no. So when I am asked a question that I'm trying to answer, please allow me to answer. Robert, the Ten Commandments are the foundation of the Sinai Covenant, okay? God speaks those words to Israel. Where? From Mount Sinai in Exodus, the 20th chapter. And then the people say, we can't hear God's voice anymore. We can't hear his voice anymore. You speak to us. So now God gives the rest of the covenant. And then in Exodus 24, the first foundations that are given, the Ten Commandments and the other commandments that were given through chapter 24, he reads them to the people and they say, yes, we'll do what God is saying. And then the rest is reiterated. Throughout the Sinai Covenant and other passages, you know, Leviticus 19 or Exodus 31 or other passages, that your Sabbath is reiterated. Sabbath is reiterated. Exodus 35, it's reiterated. It's spoken of again because it was part of the Sinai Covenant. And Ezekiel 21 reminds us it was a sign that God gave to Israel. So, no, I do not believe that under the new covenant that God is commanding in a binding way all people, Jew and Gentile, in Jesus to observe the seventh-day Sabbath. Anyone called to do so can do so. That was a covenantal sign God gave with Israel and the Jewish people. And for everyone, it now speaks to us of the call to enter into God's rest and to experience the rest that Messiah gives us. But no, the seventh-day Sabbath command is not given for Gentile believers in the New Testament. In fact, in the early church, that would have been totally foreign, the idea that for many that was just part of the work week where they were, that was the command to the Sabbath. And what about under the Sinai Covenant, Robert? The penalty for not observing the Sabbath was death. If we're still under the Sinai Covenant, then you're still under a death penalty for not observing. So, no, that is part of the Sinai Covenant. Those that feel called to be part of a Messianic Jewish congregation and Jewish believers that feel called specially to live in this way, wonderful. But it is not a New Testament command. Read through Galatians 3, where Paul explains that the law, speaking of the Sinai Covenant, was given to us as a pedagogue, as a schoolmaster, as someone to protect and watch over and ensure our education, as that a slave that would have that role in the ancient world, that's what they would do. But now that Messiah has come, that was just to bring us to the Messiah. That's the scaffolding of the building. And once the building is erected, the scaffolding is no longer needed. Robert, I hope that's helpful. I don't want to be rude, but again, it's very important, not just for a good radio so that people can hear one person at a time, but you did ask a question. I'm doing my best to help you understand, but start with the realization that the Ten Commandments are part of the Sinai Covenant. Start there. And if you don't believe me, start reading in Exodus 19, and read through right till Exodus 31. You tell me if the Sabbath is Ten Commandments and the Sabbath commandment are part of the Sinai Covenant or not. Hey, just want to bring to your attention, friends, that YouTube has been making all kinds of changes in its algorithms and what gets posted, what doesn't get posted, what gets recommended, what doesn't get recommended. And as we were talking about this as our team the other day, it's affecting different people on YouTube all over the place. In other words, it's not just conservatives, it's not just followers of Jesus, but it's affecting us. So we work really hard to put out quality videos day in, day out, our full hour of the Line of Fire every single day. Many of you watching right now on Ask Dr. Brown YouTube channel. We do that, and then we record other short talks, or we pull out excerpts from the show that it's standalone, and we put those out, and we do our best to do it in a quality way. And then because most of the videos are monetized, that then, as people watch, that just brings in additional income for the ministry, which we put back into more videos and more production time. So with what YouTube's done recently, more than cut in half the funds that were coming in. Now, we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars coming in anyway, all right? Or even tens of thousands, but the money that was coming in has been more than cut in half. A way that you could help offset that is to become a Patreon partner and give $10 or more per month. It's that simple. Go to patreon.com/AskDrBrown, patreon.com/AskDrBrown. If you go there, then you will immediately be able to stand with us and make up some of this lack. And our way of saying thank you is we give you two bonus videos every single week. Yeah, it's our way of blessing you and saying thank you. Two bonus videos a week, a special teaching, and then our YouTube chat. So if you sign up now, you've got dozens and dozens of videos to enjoy already. So join our support team. This is the easiest way to do it, and it's so inexpensive that I know most of you, I believe, are able to do it. And just it'll help make up some of the shortfall as we continue to do our best to put out high-quality material without compromise. We're not going to back down from our convictions if we get demonetized, if we get censored, whatever. We're going to keep speaking the truth. So we're determined to do that. But we do it with your help. Those that have contributed watching on YouTube today in our live chat, thank you so much. So again, patreon.com/ ASK Dearborn. It would help make up a shortfall now because of YouTube's new policies. God bless. Back with you live from St. Louis tomorrow. God bless.